Two or three other channels were continually transmitting the sales pitches of hawkers, the likes of which one finds at every market fair. Here, too, the claptrap was casually overlaid with text in every corner of the screen. The dealers themselves broke every basic rule of serious oration. Indeed, they made not the slightest effort to give an impression of trustworthiness, and even the older ones wore ghastly earrings like your average gypsy. Their role-playing called upon the worst traditions of confidence trickery. One of them would spout forth the most preposterous lies, while another stood beside him exclaiming, "Hey!" and "No!" or even, "That's unbelievable!" A complete farce which filled me with the urge to turn an 8-8 flak on the assembled vermin and have the untruths splattered from the scoundrel's guts. My anger was partly induced by a mounting fear that I would go mad in the face of such collective lunacy. When I tried to switch back to the oversized woman, it was a sort of escape. I got stuck, however, on the channel where the amateurish lawyer had been up to such frightful mischief. Now a courtroom drama was playing, whose lead actress I at first mistook for the Chancellor I had seen on the news. It soon turned out, however, that she was merely a courtroom matron who closely resembled the Chancellor. The case being tried was that of a certain Sandy, who seemed to have been charged with a variety of irregularities at her educational establishment. The 16-year-old girl had only committed these offences, however, on account of her fondness for a boy called Andy, who was entertaining relations with three female students at the same time, one of whom was evidently an actress, or wished to become one. Due to inexplicable circumstances, however, she had put this career on hold in favour of a sideline in the criminal world, and now was part owner of a betting shop. More utter nonsense along similar lines was reeled off, while the courtroom matron nodded keenly, her face a picture of utter seriousness, as if these absurd tales were the most normal thing in the world and actually happened on a daily basis. I simply could not fathom it. Who would choose to watch rubbish like this? Untermenschen, perhaps, who can barely read and write, but besides them? Practically deadened, I switched back to the rotund woman. Since my last visit, her adventure-filled life had been interrupted by a programme of advertisements, the end of which I just caught. Then the narrator insisted on explaining to me for the umpteenth time that this wretched bint had lost all control over her bastard half-wit excuse for a daughter, and all she had managed to accomplish in the last half hour was to prattle on to a chain-smoking neighbour about throwing the little cretin out. "This entire coterie of hopeless cases belongs in a labour camp," I declared vociferously to the television set. "The apartment should be renovated, or, even better, demolished along with the rest of the house, and a parade ground built in its stead, so as to expunge for good these calamitous goings-on from the wholesome minds of the German Volk." Exasperated, I hurled the control box into the waste paper basket. What a superhuman task lay ahead of me. To subdue my fury, I decided to step outside. Not for long, for I did not wish to be far from the telephone, but long enough to dash to the Blitz cleaners to fetch my uniform. I entered the shop with a sigh, was greeted as Herr Stromberg, picked up my surprisingly immaculate soldier's coat, and briskly made my way back. I could scarcely wait to face the world again in familiar clothing. Naturally, the first thing the receptionist said when I returned was that there had been a telephone call for me. "Aha," I said. "Of course, it would have had to happen while I was out. Who was it?" "No idea," the receptionist said, staring blankly at her television set. "Did you not make a note of the name?" I shouted impatiently. "They said they'd ring back," she said in an attempt to excuse her misconduct. "Was it important?" "The future of Germany is at stake," I said in disgust. "Whatever," she said, returning to gawp at her screen. "Got no mobile?"
Mobile?
I spat.
Yeah,
she said.
It's like handy. Like handy?
I screamed in a rage.
Is this another tramp who's gone running to court because she lost her apprenticeship?
I turned on my heel and marched to my room to resume my study of the television. Chapter 8. It was remarkable how much more recognizable I was in my usual clothing. When I entered the cab, the driver greeted me sulkily but with a definite air of familiarity.
All right, Governor. Back then, are we?
Indeed, I replied, nodding to the man. I gave him the address.
Right you are.
I leaned back. I had not ordered any specific type of cab, but if this were an average model, it was an excellent ride.
What type of automobile is this?
I asked him nonchalantly.
Mercedes.
I was suddenly overcome by a wave of nostalgia, a wonderful feeling of security. I thought of Nuremberg, the magnificent rallies, the journey through the delightful old town, the late summer, early autumn wind, which would prowl around the peak of my cap like a wolf. I had one of these once, I said dreamily. A convertible.
And? The driver asked. Drive well.
I do not have a license myself, I said, but Kempka never voiced any complaints.
So you're a Führer who's never in the driving seat?
The man burst out laughing.
Good joke, eh?
It's an old one. There was a brief pause in the conversation. Then the driver started up again.
Well, still got it, the car, or did you sell it?
To tell you the truth, I have no idea what became of it, I said.
Shame, the driver said. So, what are you doing in Berlin? Winter Gardens? The Red Cock?
Red Cock?
You know, what theatre? Where are you appearing?
First of all, I intend to speak on the radio.
I knew it, the driver said. Got grand plans again, have we?
Destiny forges plans, I said firmly.
I am merely doing what needs to be done, both now and in the future, for the preservation of the nation.
You are really good.
I know. Fancy a little detour to your old haunts?
Perhaps later I should hate to be unpunctual. This, after all, was the reason for having ordered a cab. Given my limited means, I had offered to walk to the firm's headquarters or take the tramway, but anticipating possible traffic congestion or other imponderables, Sensenbrink had insisted on my taking a cab. I peered out of the window to see if I could still recognize parts of the capital. It was no simple task, especially as the driver was avoiding the main thoroughfares to save time. Seeing very few old buildings, I nodded with contentment. It appeared as though almost nothing had been left behind for the enemy. What I still had not fathomed was how, after barely 70 years, such a large metropolis could be standing again. Did Rome not scatter salt in the earth of vanquished Carthage? Had it been down to me, I would have dispersed trainloads of salt in Moscow, or in Stalingrad. Berlin, on the other hand, was no vegetable garden. The creative man can build a colosseum even on saline earth. As far as construction technology and engineering are concerned, of course, a ton of salt in the soil is actually quite irrelevant. Moreover, it was quite probable that the enemy had been as awestruck when faced with the rubble of Berlin as the Avars had been before the ruins of Athens. And then, in a desperate attempt to preserve the culture, they had rebuilt the city only as well as second and third class races are able. For there was no doubt about it. Even at first glance, the trained eye could see that the vast majority of structures erected here were inferior. A frightful mishmash, compounded by the fact that wherever one looked, the same shops appeared. To begin with, I thought we were driving around in circles, until I realized that Herr Starbuck owned dozens of coffee houses. The diversity of bakeries had gone, a chain of butchers was everywhere, and I even spotted several Yilmaz Blitz cleaners. The houses, too, were built to a very unimaginative design. The edifice that accommodated the production company was no exception. It was hard to believe that in 500 or 1,000 years people would stand here, marvelling at this insipid block of concrete. I was heartily disappointed. The building resembled one of those former assembly plants. Perhaps this all-encompassing production company was not all it was cracked up to be. A young, blonde, rather heavily made-up lady met me at reception to escort me to the conference room. I shudder to describe this place, with its bare concrete walls, broken up occasionally by exposed brickwork. There was scarcely a door in sight. Here and there one could see into large rooms where a number of people were working at their television sets beneath bright fluorescent tubes. The impression one gained was that the munitions workers had left but a few minutes ago. Telephones rang incessantly, and all of a sudden I realized why the folk had been obliged to spend a fortune on ringtones. So that in this labor camp one could at least tell when one's own phone was ringing. "I assume that everything here is down to the Russians," I said. "Well, sort of," the young lady said with a smile. "But you must have read that in the end they didn't come in, unfortunately. All we've got now are American locusts." "Locusts," I sighed. It was as I had always feared. No Lebensraum. No land to produce bread to feed the Volk. So now Germans were resorting to eating insects like Negroes. Gazing at the poor young thing, I was moved as she strode steadfastly beside me. I cleared my throat, but I fear that she may have picked up on my emotion when I said to her, "You are a very brave girl." "You bet," she beamed. "I don't want to remain an assistant forever." Of course, an assistant. She was undertaking ancillary work for the Russians. Offhand, I was unable to explain how such an arrangement could have come to pass in this modern world, but it bore all the hallmarks of those Russian vermin. I could not bear to contemplate what these activities under the yoke of Bolshevism might consist of, but I stopped abruptly and grabbed her arm. "Look at me," I said. And when she turned her head, somewhat startled, I stared her straight in the eye and said solemnly, "I make you this promise. You will live for the future that your background deserves. I personally will do all I can so that you and every other German woman no longer have to serve these Untermenschen. You have my word, Fräulein." "Özlem," she said. I still recall how unpleasant this moment was. For a fraction of a second, my brain searched for an explanation as to how an honest German girl like her could come to have a name like Özlem. Of course, I failed to find one. I removed my hand from her arm, turned, and continued walking. I felt so deceived, so betrayed, that I wished I could leave this bogus woman behind. But I did not know where I was going, so I followed her in silence, resolving to tread more carefully in this new era. How extraordinary! These Turks were not only in the cleaning industry, they seemed to be everywhere. When we arrived at the conference room, Sensenbrink came to meet me and led me inside. A group of people were sitting around a relatively long table, assembled from a number of smaller parts. I recognized Savatsky, too, the fellow who had made the hotel reservation. Besides him, there were half a dozen young men in suits and a woman who must be Bellini. She was around 40 years old, with dark hair, and probably came from the South Tyrol. As soon as I entered the room, I sensed that this woman was more of a man than all the other nincompoops here put together. Holding my arm, Sensenbrink tried to take me to the other end of the table, where, as I could see out of the corner of my eye, they had improvised some sort of stage or podium. With a subtle twist of my body, I left him grasping thin air, marched up to the woman, removed my peaked cap, and gripped the underside of her arm.
"This is Frau Bellini,"
Sensenbrink said, quite unnecessarily.
"Executive Vice President of Flashlight, Frau Bellini, our promising new discovery, Herr, Hitler," I interjected, to put an end to his futile stammering.
"Adolf Hitler, former High Chancellor of the Greater German Reich."
She offered me her hand, which I raised to my lips as I bowed my head, but not too deeply. Then I stood upright again.
"I am delighted to make your acquaintance, madam. Together, we can change Germany."
She smiled, somewhat uncertainly, I thought, but I knew from past experience the particular effect I have on women. It is virtually impossible for a woman to feel nothing when in the presence of the commander-in-chief of the most powerful army on earth. To forestall any unnecessary embarrassment on her part, I said,
"Gentlemen,"
to the company around the table, and finally turned back to Sensenbrink. "So, my dear Sensenbrink, where had you envisaged that I should sit?" He pointed to a chair at the far end of the table. I had thought as much. This was not the first time that so-called industrialists had presumed they could gauge the importance of a future German Führer. Well, I was certainly planning to demonstrate my importance, but it was doubtful whether they would be able to handle it.
"Okay," said Sensenbrink. "Sprinkle your magic. What are you bringing to the table?"
"Myself," I said.
"No, I mean, what are you going to say to us today?" I promise not to mention Poland again,"
Savatsky exclaimed with a grin.
"Good,"
I said.
"That is progress indeed. I think the question is obvious. How can you help me to help Germany?"
"How do you intend to help Germany?" Frau Bellini asked, giving me and the others a strange wink.
"In your heart of hearts, I believe all of you around this table know what this country needs. On my way here, I have seen the rooms in which you are obliged to work, these warehouses in which you and your comrades are forced to perform compulsory labor. Speer was not squeamish when it came to the efficient deployment of foreign workers, but these cramped conditions."
"These are open-plan offices," one of the men said. "You find them everywhere."
"Are you trying to tell me that this was your idea?" I probed.
"What do you mean, my idea?" he said, laughing as he looked around at the others.
"All of us here decided it."
"Look here," I said, getting up and turning to face Frau Bellini. "This is precisely my argument. I am speaking of responsibility. I am speaking of decisions. Who installed these massive cages? Was it him?" I pointed to the man whose idea it had not been.
"Or him?"
Now I glared at Sensenbrink's neighbor.
"Or Herr Savatsky? But I have grave doubts. I do not know, or, to put it better, these gentlemen here do not know themselves. And what are your workers supposed to do if they cannot comprehend their own words in their workplace? If they have to spend a fortune on ringtones, just so that they can distinguish their telephone from that of their neighbor? Who bears the responsibility? Who will help the German worker in his time of need? To whom can he turn? Will his superior help? No. For he sends the worker to that man there, and that man there in turn sends him to another. And is this an isolated case? No, it is no isolated case, but a disease creeping stealthily throughout Germany. When you buy a cup of coffee today, do you know who is responsible for it? Who makes the coffee? This gentleman here," I said, pointing once more at the man whose idea it had not been. "This gentleman here naturally believes that it is Herr Starbuck. But you, Frau Bellini, you and I both know that Herr Starbuck cannot make coffee everywhere at the same time. Nobody knows who brews the coffee. All we know for sure is that it was not Herr Starbuck. And when you go to the cleaners, do you know who cleaned your uniform? Who is this supposed Yilmaz? Do you understand? This is why we need change in Germany. A revolution! We need responsibility and strength. A leadership which takes decisions and stands by them with body and soul, with everything. If you wish to attack Russia, you cannot say, as your colleague would like to, "Actually, we all decided this together." Shall we encircle Moscow? I know. Let's sit around a table and decide with a show of hands. It's all so jolly convenient, and if the whole thing goes wrong, then all of us are to blame, or, even better, the people are to blame because they elected us. No. Germany must be told once more about Russia. Russia was not Brauchitsch. It was not Guderian. It was not Göring. It was me! The Autobahn! That was not any old clown. It was the Führer! And this must be the case throughout the country! When you eat a roll in the morning, you'll know it was the baker. When you march into rump Czechoslovakia tomorrow, you'll know it was the Führer! I sat down again. There was silence around me. "That's not funny," Sensenbrink's neighbour said. "Scary," said the gentleman whose idea it had not been.
"Told you he was good, didn't I? Uber good," Sensenbrink said proudly. "Mad,"
hotel reserver Savatsky said, although it was unclear what he meant by this.
"Impossible,"
Sensenbrink's neighbour said firmly. Frau Bellini leaned forward. All heads turned to her at once. "Your problem," she said, "is that you're all conditioned by these modern stand-up routines." Shrewdly, she allowed her comment to hit home before continuing. In any case, no one else dared say a word. "You lot think good comedy is when the guy up on stage laughs more than those in the audience. Look at the comedy scene today. Nobody can deliver a punchline anymore without laughing their bloody head off, just so everyone knows it's the punchline. And if one of them keeps anything like a straight face, then we switch on the background laughter."
"Successful formula, though,"
said a man who had not spoken until then. "Maybe," the lady said. She was beginning to make a considerable impression on me. "But what's going to follow that? I think we've reached the point where the public are taking that sort of stuff for granted. The first person to adopt a completely new approach will leave the competition for dead. Isn't that right, Herr Hitler?"
"Propaganda is crucial," I said. "You need to send out a different message from the other parties."
"Tell me," she said, "did you prepare all this?"
"Why would I?"
I said. "I fashioned the cornerstone of my ideology a very long time ago. It enables me to apply my knowledge to every single aspect of world affairs and draw the correct conclusions. Do you really think you can learn how to be a Führer in your universities?" She slapped her hand on the table.
"He's improvising,"
she beamed.
"He just comes out with it. And doesn't even pull a silly face. Do you know what that means? It means he's not the type who runs out of things to say after a couple of programs, or whimpers that we need to give him more writers. Am I right, Herr Hitler?"
"I do not like so-called writers meddling in my work," I said.
"When I was writing Mein Kampf, Stolzenziani frequently..."
"I'm beginning to understand what you mean, Carmen," said the man whose idea it had not been. He laughed. "And we'll use him as a foil," Frau Bellini said,
"where he'll make the biggest impact. We're going to give him a permanent slot on Ali Gagmez."
"He's going to love us for that,"
Savatsky said.
"He ought to take a look at his viewing figures," Frau Bellini said. "The figures now, where they were 2 years ago, and where they'll be soon."
"The other channels had better get all their ducks in a row,"
Sensenbrink said. "There's just one thing I want to get straight," Frau Bellini said, suddenly looking at me very seriously.
"What is that?"
"We're all agreed that the Jews are no laughing matter."
"You are absolutely right," I concurred, almost relieved. At last, here was someone who knew what she was talking about.
Chapter 9. Nothing is more dangerous for a fledgling movement than meteoric success. One has taken one's first steps, acquired a few supporters here, given a speech there, maybe even annexed Austria or the Sudetenland. And it's all too easy to think one has reached an interim stage from where the final victory is more easily in one's grasp. And, in truth, I did achieve some astonishing things in a very short period of time, which only confirmed that I had been the choice of fate herself. When I think of all those battles I had to fight in 1919 and 1920, how the press blew up a storm in my face, how the bourgeois parties drivelled, how I painstakingly tore apart the web of Jewish lies, strand by strand, only to watch the glands of that noisome pest spin even stickier deceptions around me once again, and all the while the enemy, hundreds or thousands of times superior, sprayed new, ever more abominable poisons. Yet after only a handful of days in this modern epoch, I had gained access to the broadcast media, a vehicle for propaganda which the political opposition seemed to have entirely neglected. Why, it was too good to be true. What had the enemy learned of the art of public communication over the past 60 years? Precisely nothing. In their shoes, I would have made all manner of films. Romances in far-off countries aboard vast, strength-through-joy ships, crossing the South Seas or cruising up the awe-inspiring Norwegian fjords. Tales of young Wehrmacht soldiers courageously essaying their first ascent of towering cliffs, only to die at the foot of a rock face in the arms of their true love, a section leader in the League of German Girls, who, devastated yet hardened by the tragedy, devotes her life to National Socialist women's policy. In her belly, she carries the brave scion of her dead lover, and with such a love affair, one might even disregard the fact that they were unmarried. For where the voice of pure blood speaks, even heaven must remain silent. At all events, she cannot forget his final words as she steps into the valley at twilight, watched by a herd of admiring dairy cows. The sky gradually fades into a mighty swastika flag. Now, what films those would be! I swear that the very next day they would run out of application forms for the League of German Women at every branch headquarters. Her name should be Sieglinde. Anyway, the political opportunities of this medium had been completely ignored. According to my television set, all the government appeared to have done for the Volk was to enact a measure which was called the Job Seekers Allowance. Everyone loathed it. Nobody seemed able to utter its name without sounding offended. I could only hope that these people were not representative of society as a whole, for even mobilizing the last reserves of my imagination, I could not envision any sort of flag parade on the Nuremberg Zeppelinfeld with hundreds of thousands of whiners like them. My negotiations with Frau Bellini could likewise be considered a success. From the outset, I had made it absolutely clear that, besides money, I would need a party apparatus and a party headquarters. At first, she looked somewhat taken aback, but then she assured me of her wholehearted support, as well as an office and a typist. There was a generous expenses budget to cover clothing, propaganda trips, research materials to bring me up to date with current events, and many other things besides. Money did not appear to be a problem. But there was little understanding of the requirements of a prestigious party leader. So although I was promised several historically accurate suits from a bespoke tailor's, as well as my beloved hat, which I always used to wear in the mountains and on the Obersalzberg, an open-top Mercedes with a chauffeur was turned down flat, on the basis that it would look terribly silly. I gave in, reluctantly, but only for appearance's sake. After all, I had already achieved substantially more than I could have hoped for. In hindsight, this was, without question, the most dangerous moment in my new career. Another man might well have sat back in his chair at this point, and in so doing ended up a failure. Not I. Perhaps, owing to the maturity of my years, I alone subjected all developments to the coldest, most ruthless analysis. My supporters were fewer in number than ever before. And, mein Gott, there had been times in the past when they were in terribly short supply. I have a clear recollection of that occasion back in 1919 when I paid my first visit to what was then still the German Workers' Party. 7 people were present. Now, I was able to count myself, perhaps Frau Bellini at a push, and the kiosk owner. But it was doubtful whether the two of them were ready to fill out their party cards, let alone start counting membership subscriptions or act as stewards, brandishing chair legs at assemblies. The newspaper seller seemed to be a particularly liberal soul, even left-leaning, although he was unquestionably in possession of an honest German heart. I continued to dedicate myself to the iron discipline of my daily routine. I rose at 11 in the morning, had the hotel staff bring me a slice or two of cake, and then I would work until late into the night. That is to say, I would have risen at 11, had not the telephone rung out at the crack of dawn, around 9. On the line was a lady with an unpronounceable name of Slavic origin. Jodl would never have put someone like that through to me, but Jodl, alas, was German history. Still woozy with sleep, I hunted for the receiver. Good morning, Frau Krautschik here, a mercilessly cheerful voice sang out. From Flashlight! What irritates me most of all about these morning people is their horribly good temper, as if they had been up for 3 hours and already conquered France. Particularly since the vast majority of them, in spite of rising so appallingly early, have performed anything but great deeds. In Berlin, I have time and again met people who make no secret of the fact that their only reason for stirring at such an ungodly hour of the morning is so that they can leave the office earlier in the afternoon. I have suggested to several of these 8-hour logicians that they ought to start work at 10 o'clock at night, thereby allowing them to leave at 6 in the morning and perhaps even arrive home before it is time to get up. Some even took this for a serious suggestion. In my opinion, only bakers need to work early in the morning. And the Gestapo, of course, that is self-evident. To tear the Bolshevist rabble from their beds, so long as they are not Bolshevist bakers. For they would already be awake, and thus the Gestapo, for their part, would have to get up even earlier, and so on and so forth. How can I help you?
I'm calling from the contracts department,
the voice exulted.
I'm just preparing your documents, and I've got a few questions. I don't know, should we do it over the phone, or would you rather come in?
What sort of questions?
Oh, you know, very general ones. Social insurance, bank details, that sort of stuff. For example, what name should I put on the contract?
What name?
I mean, I don't know what your name is.
Hitler, I groaned. Adolf.
Yeah!
She laughed again with her blood-curdling morning enthusiasm.
No, I meant your real name.
Hitler Adolf, I said, indignant now. A brief silence followed.
Really?
Yes, of course.
Well, that's a coincidence.
A coincidence? How so?
You know, that you're called...
For goodness sake, woman, you have a name too. But I'm not sitting here wide-eyed and screeching, "Ooh, what a coincidence!"
I know, but you look like it too. Your name, I mean.
And? So you look quite different from your name, do you?
No, but...
Well then, in God's name, get those damned papers finished! I barked, slamming down the receiver. 7 minutes later, the telephone rang again.
What now?
Yes, it's me again, Frau...
And then came that queer oriental name which sounded like someone scrunching up a Wehrmacht report.
I'm afraid it's not going to work.
What is not going to work?
Look, I don't want to be unfriendly, but it will never get through the legal department. I can't. I mean, when they look at the contract and see Adolf Hitler there...
Well, what else would you want to write?
Please excuse me for asking you again, but is that really your name?
No, I said, tortured. Of course not.
My real name is Shmuel Rosenzweig.
I knew it, she said with audible relief.
How do you write that? Shmuel with a C?
That was a joke!
I screamed into the receiver.
Oh, damn, pity.
I could hear her crossing something out several times. Then she said,
Please, I think it might be better if you did pop by after all. I need something like a passport and your bank details.
Ask Bormann, I said curtly into the receiver and hung up. Then I sat down. This was irritating and complicated. Feeling sorry for myself, indeed, on the brink of despair, I let my thoughts wander back to loyal Bormann. Bormann, who always organized feature films for me so that I could enjoy a little evening relaxation after a hard day's warmongering. Bormann, who had arranged everything so smoothly with the residents of the Obersalzberg. Bormann, who had also dealt with the income from my book sales. Bormann, the most loyal of them all. With him by my side, I was confident that many, most things, in fact, were in the best possible hands. He would have sorted out contracts like this without the tiniest hitch. This is your last warning, foul Qatar throat. You will issue these contract documents at once, or you and your family will find yourselves in Dachau. And I'm sure you are aware of just how many people come back from there. Bormann's empathy and sensitivity, his ability to deal with people, were greatly underestimated. He would have found me an apartment in a flash, as well as an impeccable set of personal documents, bank accounts, everything. On second thought, it might be more accurate to say that he would have ensured nobody requested such bureaucratic niceties a second time. But now life had to go on without him, and somehow the matter of my papers had to be settled. How I would have handled this in the 1930s was anybody's guess, but now, for better or worse, I had to follow present-day convention. I set my keen mind to the problem. I imagined I would have to register with the authorities. And yet I had neither fixed abode nor proof of identity. The evidence for my existence was effectively based on my lodgings at the hotel and the production company's recognition of me, but on paper I had no proof to offer. I clenched my fist in fury and shook it at the ceiling. Papers! German bourgeois officialdom with its petty, mean-spirited rules and regulations. Once more, this perfidious millstone around the neck of the German people was throwing a spanner in the works. My situation seemed utterly hopeless. I could see no way out. And then the telephone rang again. Only the iron resolve and quick-wittedness of the former front-line soldier allowed me to home in on the target. I picked up, sure of finding a solution, but still uncertain as to how.
"Is Frau Krautschek from Flashlight again?"
The simple answer came to me at once.
"Listen here, woman," I said. "Put me through to Sensenbrink."
Chapter 10. It is a popular misconception that a Führer needs to know everything. He does not have to know everything. He does not even have to know most things. Indeed, it can be the case that he need not know anything at all. He can be the most ignorant of the ignorant. Yes, and blind and deaf too, in the tragic wake of an enemy bomb blast. On a wooden leg, or even without arms and legs, rendering the Nazi salute impossible at parades. And when the German anthem is sung, only a bitter tear runs from a lifeless eye. I will even postulate that a Führer can be without memory, a total amnesiac. For a Führer's unique talent is not the accumulation of dry facts. His unique talent is rapid decision-making and assuming responsibility for those decisions. Critics love to make light of this, citing the old joke about the man who, when moving house, for example, chooses to carry the responsibility rather than any crates. But in the ideal state, the leader ensures that each man is effective in just the right capacity. Bormann was not a leader, but rather a master of thought and memory. He knew everything. Some referred to him behind his back as the Führer's filing cabinet, which I always found rather touching, as I could not have hoped for a more telling endorsement of my policy. At any rate, it was a far greater compliment than I ever heard paid to Göring, the Führer's hot air balloon. Ultimately, it was this knowledge, this ability to separate the useful from the pointless, which allowed me, notwithstanding the absence of Bormann, to perceive the new opportunities offered by the production company. Given the precarious situation caused by my lack of papers, it was pointless to try to solve the problem of official registration by myself. So I assigned this task to someone who no doubt had greater maneuverability in his dealings with the authorities, Sensenbrink. Straight away, he said,
"Yeah, we'll park that one for you. You worry about your program and we'll fix everything else. What do you need going forward?"
"Ask that foul Critch thing of me. An identity card, I assume, and more besides."
"Don't you have a passport? No ID card, how is that possible?"
"I never had need of one."
"Haven't you ever been abroad?"
"Well, obviously, Poland, France, Hungary."
"Okay, they're inside the EU.
And the Soviet Union."
"You got in there without a passport?"
I thought about it for a moment. "I cannot recollect anybody having asked me for one," I replied confidently.
"Strange. But what about America? I mean, you're 56. Haven't you ever been to America?"
"I did very seriously plan to go," I said. "But unfortunately, I was stopped in my tracks."
"Okay, so all we need are your papers. Then I'm sure one of us can operationalize the registration and health insurance for you."
"This is the problem. There are no papers."
"No papers?
None at all.
Not even at your girlfriend's? I mean at home?"
"My last home," I said, sadly, "was devoured by flames."
"I see. Oh, you're being serious now.
Have you seen the Reich Chancellery of late?" He laughed.
"That bad?"
"I do not see what there is to laugh about," I said. "It was devastating."
"Fine," Sensenbrink said. "I'm no expert, mind, but we're going to need some sort of papers. Where were you registered before, or insured?"
"I always had something of an aversion to bureaucracy," I said. "I preferred to make the laws myself."
"Hmm," Sensenbrink sighed. "Well, I've never had a case like this before. We'll see what we can leverage, okay? But at the very least, we're going to need your real name."
"Hitler," I said. "Adolf."
"Listen, I've got every sympathy for your situation, don't get me wrong. That Schroeder chap is exactly the same. Away from the stage, he loves his peace and quiet. And given how controversial your topic is, you need to be careful as an artist. But I'm not sure the authorities will see it the same way."
"I have no interest in the details."
"I bet you don't."
Sensenbrink laughed, a touch too condescendingly for my liking.
"As far as I'm concerned, you're the consummate artist, but it really would make things easier. You see, there's no problem with tax.
The finance office is the only one that doesn't give a damn. If necessary, they'll tax illegal immigrants and negotiate cash payments.
And if you want, we can arrange all the payments and help you manage your money. So I don't expect it would be the long pole in the bank's tent. But I'll bottom line for you. It'll be like putting socks on an octopus with the registration office or social insurance. We'll be chipping out of the bunker with no green to work with."
I had no idea what the man was saying, but sensed that he was in need of moral support. The troops must not be overextended. After all, it is not every day that a Reich Chancellor, believed long dead, parades himself through the country as fresh as a daisy.
"It must be difficult for you," I said, indulging him.
"What?" "Well, I imagine you seldom encounter people like me." Sensenbrink laughed.
"Of course we do. It's our job."
His composure came as such a surprise that I had to probe further.
"So, there are more like me."
"Come on,
You know as well as I do that there are all sorts in your line of work.
And you arrange for them all to be broadcast?
Can you imagine the work we'd have on our plates? No, we only contract those we believe in.
Excellent, I said.
One must fight for the cause with fanatical belief.
Do you have Antonescu as well? Or the Duce?
Who?
You know, Mussolini.
No,
Sensenbrink said so firmly that I could see him shaking his head down the telephone wire.
What would we do with an Antonini? He's low visibility. No one knows who he is.
What, Churchill? Eisenhower? Chamberlain?
Oh, now I know which direction your arrows are firing in.
Sensenbrink roared into the telephone.
No, no. Where would the humour be in that? We'd never gain any traction. No, you're perfect as you are. We're going to stick with one character. We're going to stick with our Adolf.
Very good, I said, then immediately delved deeper.
What happens if Stalin turns up tomorrow?
You can forget Stalin, he said, pledging his allegiance. We're not the History Channel.
This was the Sensenbrink I wanted to hear. Sensenbrink the fanatic, awakened by his Führer.
And here, I cannot overemphasize the importance of a fanatical will. This was most clearly demonstrated by the course of the last World War, which was not always unproblematic.
No doubt, some will say, was it really a lack of fanatical will which resulted in the Second World War ending as unfavorably as the First? Was there not perhaps another reason, maybe an insufficient supply of manpower? All of this is feasible, even possibly correct, but it is also the symptom of an ancient German disease, namely that of hunting for mistakes in the small details while ignoring the larger, clearer picture.
Naturally, one cannot deny that we suffered from a certain numerical inferiority of troops in the last World War, but this inferiority was not decisive. On the contrary, the German Volk could have coped with a greater superiority of enemy numbers. Indeed, on a number of occasions in the early 1940s, I even regretted that the enemy did not have more troops. Just look at the inferiority enjoyed by Frederick the Great. 12 enemy soldiers to each Prussian grenadier. Whereas in Russia, it was 3 or 4 Bolshevists per Aryan warrior. It is true that after Stalingrad, the superiority of the enemy was far more befitting to the honour of the Wehrmacht. On the day of the Allied landings in Normandy, the enemy advanced with 2,600 bombers and 650 fighter planes. If I remember rightly, the Luftwaffe resisted with 2 fighter aircraft. A truly honourable ratio.
And yet the position was not hopeless.
I wholeheartedly endorse the words of Reich Minister Dr. Goebbels, who demanded that if the numerical disadvantage could not be rectified, then the German Volk must compensate for it in other ways, whether this be with better weapons, smarter generals, or, as in this case, the advantage of superior morale. At first glance, the simple fighter pilot may consider it a near hopeless task to take 3 bombers out of the sky with every shot, but with superior morale, with an unwavering, fanatical spirit, everything is possible. This holds as true today as it did back then. And now I came across an example of fanaticism that even I would have thought impossible. And yet, it was perfectly genuine. I observed a man, an employee of my hotel, I presume, who was engaged in a fascinating new activity. In fact, I cannot be absolutely sure that this activity is new. It is just that I remember it being performed differently, that is to say, with a broom or a rake. This man wielded a completely new type of portable leaf-blowing machine, a mesmerizing apparatus with extraordinary blowing power, which I expect had become necessary to confront the more resistant forms of foliage that evolution must have given rise to over the intervening years. I was able to infer from this that the racial struggle is far from over. On the contrary, it continues to surge in nature with greater intensity. Not even today's bourgeois liberal press dares to deny it.
One reads of the American grey squirrel supplanting the indigenous red species, so beloved of the German folk. Of tribes of African ants marching across the Iberian Peninsula. Of Indo-Germanic balsams naturalizing and spreading in this country. This last development is to be welcomed, of course. Aryan plants have every right to colonize the space which is their due. Now, I had not seen this novel, more combative foliage at close quarters. The leaves on the hotel's motor park seemed perfectly normal to me. But the blowing apparatus could just as easily be deployed against traditional leaves. After all, when driving a Koenigstiger tank, you do not restrict yourself to taking on T-34s. If necessary, you engage the old BT-7s, too. When, for the first time, I observed the man, I was indignant. I had been woken that morning. It may have been around 9:30, by an infernal din, as if my pillow were nestling against a Soviet rocket launcher. I rose in a fury, hurried to the window, glared out, and spotted that very man busily operating his blowing device. My wrath was only multiplied when I looked at the surrounding trees and saw that it was gusting. How absolutely preposterous it was to blow leaves from one place to another on a day like this. My first instinct was to race outside, vent my anger, and give him a proper dressing down. But I thought better of it, for I was in the wrong. The man had been issued with an order, and he was executing the order. With a fanatical loyalty, my leading generals would have done well to imitate. A man was following orders. It was as simple as that. Was he complaining? Was he moaning that it was a pointless task in this wind? No. He was performing his ear-splitting duty bravely and stoically, like a loyal SS man. Thousands of these had completed their tasks, regardless of the burden placed on them, even though they could have easily complained. What are we to do with all these Jews? It makes no sense any more. They're being delivered faster than we can load them into the gas chambers. I was so moved that I dressed swiftly, hurried out to the worker, put a hand on his shoulder and said, "My good man, I should like to thank you. It is for people like you that I will continue my struggle. For I know that from this leaf-blasting apparatus, indeed from every leaf-blasting apparatus in the Reich, blows the red-hot breath of National Socialism. That is the fanatical will this country requires." And I hoped that I had aroused it in Sensenbrink too. Chapter 11. On the morning I strode into the office put at my disposal, I was reminded again of the long path down which I yet had to travel. I entered a room which was perhaps 5 by 7 meters, with a ceiling 2 meters 50 high at most. I thought wistfully of my Reich Chancellery. Now that place had rooms. The very instant one entered, one felt dwarfed. One trembled before such power, such high culture. Not on account of the splendor. The ostentation had always left me cold. But whenever I received someone in the Reich Chancellery, I noticed at once that he felt the superiority of the German Reich, felt it physically. Speer got everything so right. Just take the great reception hall. Each chandelier alone must have weighed a ton. Had any one of them come down, they would have crushed a man below, turning him to a pulp, a mash of bones and blood and squashed flesh, with maybe some hair sticking out the side. I was almost afraid to stand beneath them myself. I never gave any hint of this, of course. Why, I strolled beneath those chandeliers as if it were the most natural thing in the world. It was just a matter of getting used to them. But that is exactly how things must be. For how could one spend millions and millions on a Reich Chancellery only for someone to come in and say to himself, "Oh, I thought it would be bigger than this." The point is, this man must not think at all. He must feel it, viscerally, instinctively. He is nothing. The German Volk is everything. A master race. The edifice must emit an aura, like a pope.
But a pope, of course, who smites the slightest contradiction with fire and sword, like the Lord God himself. The mighty double doors open, out steps the Führer of the German Reich, and foreign visitors must feel like Odysseus before the Cyclops. But this Cyclops has two eyes, over which no man will be able to pull the wool. And there were no boulders at the Chancellery. There were escalators. I almost felt as if I were in Kaufhof in Cologne, to which I had paid a visit immediately after its Aryanization. You have to hand it to him, that Tietz. The Jews certainly know how to build department stores. But here is an important distinction. In Kaufhof, the customer should think he is king, whereas when he came to the Reich Chancellery, the customer knew that he had to bow, in spirit at least, to something far greater. I was never in favour of having every Tom, Fritz, or Heinrich crawling about, especially not on that floor. The floor of the office at my disposal was made of a dark grey compound. It was no carpet I recognised, but a type of covering fabricated from a tatty felted substance, but not at all the sort of material from which one would choose to tailor a German soldier's winter uniform. I had seen its like many times in this new world. It was so ubiquitous that I did not need to feel humiliated by its presence in my office. It was plainly a feature of these impoverished times. I vowed that in the future the German worker and his family would have different floor coverings from these, and different walls. The walls here were paper-thin, no doubt due to a want of raw materials. I had a writing desk, which was manifestly second-hand, and was obliged to share the room with another desk, which must be for the typist I had been promised. I sighed deeply and gazed out of the window. It gave on to a motor park with dustbins in an array of colours, the reason for this being that waste was carefully separated, no doubt another consequence of the raw materials shortage. I shuddered to contemplate from which bin's contents the wretched floor covering had been made. Then I chuckled to myself at destiny's bitter irony. If only the Volk had made a greater effort at the right time, there would be no need to collect refuse in this manner, given the wealth of raw materials in the East. All kinds of waste could have been happily tipped into just two dustbins, or even a single one. I shook my head in disbelief. Rats scurried around in the yard below, alternating with groups of smokers. Rats, smokers, rats, smokers, and so it went on. I scrutinised once more my modest, nay, pathetic, writing desk, and the cheap, whitish wall behind it. It would not look any better, no matter what one hung up there, even a bronze imperial eagle. One would have to content oneself that the wall did not come crashing down with the weight. Once upon a time I enjoyed 400 square metres of office. Now the Führer of the Greater German Reich sat in a shoebox. What had become of the world? And what had happened to my typist? I looked at the clock. It was just after 12:30. I opened the door and peered out. Nobody was to be seen, save for a middle-aged woman in a suit. She laughed when she caught sight of me. "Oh, it's you. Are you already rehearsing? We're all terribly excited. Where is my secretary?" She stopped momentarily to think about it. Then she said, "They must have given you a part-timer, which means she'll probably only come for the afternoons, around 2. "Oh," I said, dumbfounded. "What will I do until then?" "I don't know," she said, laughing as she turned to go. "Touch of blitzkrieg, perhaps?" "I will remember that," I said, frostily. "Really?" She stopped and turned again briefly. "That's fab. It'd be great if you could use it for your program. I mean, we're all working for the same firm here." I went back into my office and closed the door. On each desk stood a typewriter without a cylinder in front of a television set, which must have been placed there by mistake. I decided to continue my research into broadcasting
but could find no operating box. It was deeply frustrating. I reached angrily for the telephone, but then replaced the receiver. I had no idea with whom the switchboard should connect me. The entire modern technological infrastructure was getting me nowhere. I sighed, and for a moment my heart pounded with an uneasy despair. But only for a moment. Resolutely, I banished the temptations of weakness. A politician makes the most of what there is, or, as in this case, of what there is not. So I might as well go outside for a while and observe the new German Volk. As I stepped out of the building, I looked about me. Opposite was a small park, whose trees were already displaying the most intense autumnal colours. To the left and right stood more houses. Out of the corner of my eye, I spied a madwoman on the edge of the park, who was gathering up what her dog had just deposited. Had this creature been sterilized, I wondered, but came to the conclusion that she could hardly